when the wind blows puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
You know what I love about Gordon Goldsborough? Many things. But one thing in particular is that every now and then he likes to shake things up when it comes to abandoned Manitoba. We've had buildings in limbo, buildings on death row, and today we're going for abandoned what, Gordon?
Cultural practices.
I like it.
Yeah, I said that last week that this week we would talk about a shooting death that occurred in the fall of 1909 as a result of an obscure and hopefully now abandoned cultural practice.
So a sorry end for this particular chap. Let's talk about the actual cultural practice that you are referring to.
Right. We're talking about the practice of something called charivari.
Say it again.
Charivari.
I love hearing you say that.
It's a French word, although it has been used apparently in French and English for a very long time, both in Europe and here in North America, in Canada and the United States for sure. There are a couple of variations on the name. It's also called chivalry or chivalry. So listeners who are familiar with it might have heard it by any of those names or maybe even others. The idea is that it was a noisy surprise visit, usually late at night, to someone who was perceived to have violated community norms. And the idea was that they were intending to humiliate, to censure the victim of this charivari. They would make a lot of noise, and they would use it a variety of things. They would bang together pots, they would ring bells, they would blow horns, they would shoot guns in the air.
All right, so when and where did this practice begin?
Well, it goes back to medieval times, and it was done throughout Europe, and the results could be incredibly severe. I mean, the treatments could involve social ostracization, the people was basically just banned from the community, or in less severe cases, you know, it might just lead, say, to making the person very aware that they had done something bad. Here in North America, charivari tended to be used most in sort of the frontier areas where there weren't forms of formal justice. In other words, you might think of it as a form of vigilante justice. And frequently, here in Manitoba at least, it was intended to express the disapproval of a marriage, such as ones that might occur between people of different ages, if the groom was much older than the bride, for example, or if the two people were of different races or of different religions. This would sometimes lead to a charivari.
How common was charivari in Manitoba's history?
Well, because of its informal nature, you know, there aren't a lot of actual statistics on the practice. So I looked in local historical newspapers to see if I could find any references to charivari. And yes, indeed, quite a few of them. Most of them, however, related to incidents elsewhere outside of Manitoba. And my guess is that they really only reported really especially bad cases where there was some kind of dramatic outcome. I think it was such a commonplace activity that it wasn't seen as newsworthy. So you wouldn't tend to see a lot of references to it. But I'll give you an example. I found a short note in the newspaper from May of 1878, and it said basically that St. Boniface had enjoyed a charivari last night. Now, why you would enjoy a charivari, I'm not quite sure. They didn't say anything about who the identity of the victims were or what they had done to warrant this treatment. Then I found another one in September of 1898. Four young men at Souris, Manitoba, were convicted by the local magistrate of having been involved in a charivari. And there was a nice little quote, I thought, that sort of described what they had done. They shouted and rattled tins, pans, and threw insults to the parties inside the house, and going up to the door, hammered with a stick on the door, leaving marks and dings therein, also demanding $2 to stop. So what it suggests then is that there was sort of an extortion element of this, that if you paid them enough, they wouldn't do it. But, you know, sometimes it seems, some of the references I found, was simply it was a way of just teasing, I guess, sort of good-naturedly in a way, the newlyweds. So I found a newspaper story from July of 1886 about a marriage at Porter's La Prairie, and it said, "The marriage of a popular local couple gave the boys and men a chance to organize a regular old-fashioned charivari last night." So again, it sort of sounds almost like it's just a commonplace thing that you just do for fun.
So coming back to your clue, how does good-natured teasing end up in a shooting of an 18-year-old man at Brookdale.
Yeah, well, it seems that this might have been one of the few times that really got out of hand during a charivari. So I'll give you some specifics. On the night of the 9th of November, 1909, 8 boys and men gathered outside a 2-story wooden house belonging to a gentleman named William McLaughlin, located just north of Brookdale. And in case you don't know where that is, Brookdale is about 20 miles northeast of Brandon. 4 days before the charivari, 35-year-old Mr. McLaughlin had married 19-year-old Ethel Burkell. And it was against the express wishes of her parents. So there's the sort of scandalous element to it, I suppose. And this marriage occurred only 8 months after the death from childbirth of McLaughlin's first wife. So maybe another element of controversy. The community, I guess, was outraged that this widowed man had not waited long enough to remarry, and by the disparity in the ages of the bride and the groom. So they wanted to express their displeasure via a charivari. And so they carried cowbells, they carried sleigh bells, and one of them apparently even had a shotgun to make noise to carry out this charivari.
So what happened?
Well, first, 2 men from the group went up to the house. They pounded on the door and they yelled their intention to charivari the occupants. They shot off the shotgun into the air and they offered to abort the charivari if McLaughlin paid them $10. So again, there's that sort of extortion motive. In response, someone inside the house shot a gun back. And over the course of the next 30 minutes or so, several rounds of gunfire were exchanged. One of those rounds of gunfire hit 18-year-old Harry Bosnell, who was outside the house. At the time, they didn't know quite what had happened, but it turned out it had perforated his intestine. And 2 days later, Mr. Bosnell died of an internal infection caused by the gunfire.
Now, you said a shot came from inside the house. Was that Mr. McLaughlin?
Well, it's not altogether clear. So a police officer did interview Mr. McLaughlin 3 days after the death, and he readily acknowledged having fired off shots, but he claimed to have shot over the heads of the men, so not expressly saying, "I shot the guy." But 2 weeks after the shooting, he was charged with manslaughter.
Was he found guilty?
Well, no. In those days, a grand jury would be called first to determine if a trial was warranted by the evidence. So they held a grand jury hearing in Minnedosa in March of 1910. They heard evidence from the Crown Attorney, and they returned what was called a no-bill decision. And what that basically meant was that while McLaughlin was not found innocent, the case could not proceed to an actual trial.
Why?
What turns out, the police officer who had talked to McLaughlin after the shooting had, well, if you've listened to American police shows, they often say anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. Now, I have no experience with the Canadian system, never having been arrested, but I think something similar to that is said when somebody is arrested here in Canada. And apparently the police officer did not say that to Mr. McLaughlin, did not tell him not to incriminate himself. The other thing is that the only witness who could have testified as to who had shot out of the house was Mr. McLaughlin's new wife. And because she was his wife, she could not be compelled to testify against her husband.
This sounds like it could be made into a podcast. Okay, so what happened to McLaughlin and also the practice of charivari at Brookdale in the aftermath of this?
I found no evidence to suggest that the McLaughlins left the community. It seems that they continued to live out their lives in quiet. And in fact, their former house, the one from which the shots had been fired, was still standing as recently as 2005, although it was abandoned. I haven't made an effort to go out to see if it's still there today. It could well be, and maybe one of our listeners from the Brookdale area can tell me if the old McLaughlin house is still there and standing. As for the practice of charivari, I was told by historian Pauline Greenhill, from whom I learned about this shooting at Brookdale, that the practice of charivari continued into this area at least into the early 1970s, although its purpose had evolved somewhat into more good-natured ribbing of newlyweds. You know, they would play simple tricks on the newlyweds that could involve things like writing racy slogans on the side of their vehicle, or maybe attaching tin cans on strings to the back of their car so when they drove away it would sort of clatter and make a bit of noise. So it seems, at least, that here in Manitoba, the cultural practice of charivari has been abandoned, if not you know, dramatically downsized in its severity.
No shotguns required.
I certainly hope not.
Gordon, thank you for this. It was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
What do we have for next week?
Well, next week I'm going to talk about a pair of rare historical documents that demonstrate the virtues of dumpster diving.
Excellent. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Gordon.
See you next week.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.